It is almost 3 a.m., and you know what that means. Witches, goblins, and ghouls are about to be at their most powerful, and supernatural activity is about to reach its climax, if you will.
So pull out your harnesses and strap on your broomsticks, because it's time for
the Bitching Hour. So for this week's episode, we are talking about being queer in healthcare, and so that can look like a lot of things, but we do talk about things including reproductive care, pelvic care, pap smears, cervical exams, gynecology, chest exams. So that can definitely be things that people have personal experiences with, and just kind of keep that in mind when you're thinking about tuning in this week.
Hi everyone, I'm Mia. I aspire to be Ethan from Lizzie McGuire, but we all know I'm really just Gordo.
No. You don't have to be down on yourself.
Gordo gets the girl.
Does he?
Lizzie.
Really?
Right?
I thought she dates that guy in Italy.
Paolo.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he turns out to be shit.
Bad news.
He's a phony. What about you, Mags?
What about me? I'm definitely a Gordo. No. I'm Maggie, and I can confirm, as of last weekend, that I can still do almost all of the dances from High School Musical 1 and 2, including, but not limited to, We're All in This Together, The Wildcat Cheer, Work This Out, and All for One. Thank you.
Thank you. Special shout out to Kenny Ortega.
Daddy. Here we go.
Okay. On this episode, we're starting off with bitchcraft. We're talking about two bad witches. Maggie is sharing an artist she loves, and I'm shouting out to one of my nursing inspirations. After that, we're launching into a discussion on queerness and healthcare, as queers who want to provide it and as queer patients. Finally, we're playing If I Was Your Boyfriend. I got a haircut and Maggie's a believer.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm so ready.
All right. Okay, so we're playing Bitchcraft today. I love that we talk about them as like mini games.
Mm-hmm. Like we're playing Bitchcraft. We're just going to talk about people we like.
Yeah. Bitchcraft, as you may well know if you're a true fan of the podcast, is a segment where we just share things about people that we love, people who are inspiring us, people we want to spread the word about. Mm-hmm. This can be artists or bloggers or writers or
BMXers.
Grandparents.
Yes.
Anybody.
Amazing. I'm going to go first today.
Hit it.
And I actually am going to talk about a friend of mine who I took adult Jewish learning classes with last year in my own apartment. So that is how I first met her. I realized like about halfway through taking these classes with her last spring, that she has been a jewelry artist for years. So she actually started designing jewelry 13 years ago as a student at Wesleyan University. Her name's Ziamara Lorenzo, and she's local to Boston. So for Boston listeners, support local, buy local, and buy her stuff on Etsy, which we will definitely put in the show notes.
Yeah.
So what makes Ziamara's jewelry so cool is that it's 3D printed.
What?
Which is, so they're incredibly, so she makes earrings. That's like that's really what it is. And they're lightweight, which is great.
Oh, cool.
Because they're big and they have like intricate designs on them, but they're not like totally weighing your ears down. And they're really, really beautiful. And so I asked her about why she did the shape that she does. And again, you'll get a chance to see it on our social media. I'll post some pictures. But there's really kind of like a continuous looping shape. And so she said that before she was even 3D printing them, she made each piece by hand using craft wire and pliers, later evolving into soldering techniques.
Wow.
She was drawn to the hoop earring shape and was reimagining it using continuous intersecting lines. She said that she focused on continuity as a key theme because of her interest in continual personal growth.
Oh my gosh.
Which is very, very cool.
That's beautiful.
Very, very cool. So she says that Ziamara Lorenzo Designs operates from the mantra continuous, begin where you end. What this means is that no matter who you think you are, how you identify, in order to keep growing, you must see through and beyond how you define yourself. You never really end. However you define yourself is really just a jumping off point to eventually grow beyond those boundaries.
Oh my God, I love that.
So absolutely gorgeous earrings and really, really cool kind of personal philosophy behind them. So definitely support her. Again, I'll post some links, but you can find her on Facebook, facebook.com/ZiamaraDesigns. Twitter is also handle ZiamaraDesigns. She has an Etsy and you really should buy local. So, and if you don't live in Boston, buy far, far away.
Yeah. That's amazing. I love the idea of like, kind of like using a tactile physical thing to work through like a personal philosophy or to like represent it. Like I love the idea of making something, but the backbone of making a physical thing is like this ideology about yourself and identity and
it is world. Really cool. It's I think it really beautiful. Connects like how you're physically interacting with things with where your brain seems to be, like that it is grounded. And it's funny, you know, I asked her what the ongoing inspiration was for continuing to do this for so long. And she said that engaging in new technologies has really expanded her relationship with art and has brought her closer to what inspired her in the first place. So like even moving through the different textures and the different, you know, methods that she was using has allowed her to continue to work through the philosophy. So
yeah,
very cool.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So Mia, who do you have this week?
So I want to talk about Clara Moon. Clara is an Instagrammer, is how I originally found her, but she's a blogger as well. And Clara is a nursing student. She's from Atlanta and she's very popular on Instagram. Her Instagram handle is Clara's Clean Eats.
Clara's Clean Eats.
And so she started being like, you know, an advocate for health and fitness and food and all this stuff. And she really is inspiring in a lot of ways. The ways that she talks about self-care and, you know, in a community that's about like fitness blogging and health blogging, it can be really overwhelming and often not so healthy. And she puts forward like a really powerful and balanced mindset about like having a three-dimensional life and pursuing health and wellness. The reason I came to follow her is because she is a nursing student. She's actually graduating in, I think, just a few weeks. And she's pursuing her WHNP, which is Women's Health Nurse Practitioner degree. Okay. So that's something I'm interested in as well. She's interested in midwifery and all these similar things that I'm interested in. And through just like having similar interests and being a huge fan of hers, I started to communicate with her on Instagram, which is really cool. Like when someone you really look up to and someone who kind of, you know, puts like a face to your aspirations and is like a real person who's doing it.
Like a landmark or a guidepost.
It's like, oh, that. She's doing it. And she's also managing to talk about self-care. And she's also managing to talk about times where she doesn't do as good of a job taking care of herself.
Right.
Or, you know, times when her positive attitude falters for a second, or like relationship struggles. She's in a long distance relationship, which I think the long distance part is coming to an end. She just recently got engaged, which is very exciting.
Congratulations.
So, you know, she like talks about these real life things and portrays like a very realistic portrait of nursing school, which is hard itself, but also can kind of become this monster because of the way people talk about it, which is, it's not easy, but she's very realistic and talks about ways of managing stress and ways of taking care of yourself and, you know, accomplishing your goals and working towards what you want and also still being a real person.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
awesome.
Just two awesome witches.
Seriously. And really it's going to be a good lead in to our main word today.
Yeah. Maggie, do you want to introduce the main brew?
So as you all know, Mia is in nursing school, and I think I've said on previous episodes that I am an aspiring occupational therapist, and currently work at a geriatric hospital. So both of us are in health sciences and are both queer and both have bodies and minds and our patients. So we need stuff too.
We need stuff.
So we wanted to talk about both sides of that coin. We wanted to talk about being kind of aspiring health workers, but also accessing health ourselves from a queer perspective. Because I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk about this was that I, when I've spoken to, for example, like even straight people in my family about accessing healthcare as a queer person, I don't think it occurs to people like what it looks like to be queer and like trying to go to the doctor and like what, so I'm excited to kind of get into that.
Yeah.
So let's start by talking about kind of why we are going into health. So Mia, let it rip. Yeah. Why nursing school? Why nursing in general?
So an interesting thing that happens every time someone asks me why I want to be a midwife mm-hmm. is that I say, well, I was really interested in abortion. Mm-hmm. And by that, I don't mean I was interested in abortion. And in that, I mean I was interested in advocating for people's right to choose. Mm-hmm. And I was in a student group called Civil Liberties and Public Policy at Hampshire College while we were at Mount Holyoke. They have a conference every year that's about reproductive justice. And through my interest in reproductive justice, I kind of came to be interested in the ways that people give birth. Mm-hmm. And the more that I learned about, you know, kind of the streamlining of birth in hospitals, you know, modern birth is all about efficiency and all about, mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. C-section rate is incredibly high.
Right.
And it's rising globally as well. Like other places, it's like outrageously high. And so the more I became interested in helping people have a birth experience that's meaningful to them and positive if it can be. And so I became interested in that kind of stuff. So feminist healthcare is really important to me. And nursing, I really wanted to do an accelerated nursing program. I wanted to do a second bachelor's and I want to work for a bit because to me it's really important to kind of ground that work in being with patients. So right. when I graduate, I hope to work in labor and delivery with patients mm-hmm. Before going on to pursue a master's and a certification in midwifery.
Right.
I've talked about this before and I feel like myself when I'm taking care of other people physically. Mm-hmm. And so my two interests kind of lie in birth and in death. Mm-hmm. So I eventually want to work in labor and delivery and become a midwife is my main goal, but I would love to be able to work in hospice care mm-hmm. as well someday.
That is so cool.
How about you, Maggie?
So I really agree with the idea of kind of grounding your interests and grounding what kind of drives you in practice and working with patients. So I have worked in research. I've worked in health science research since I graduated from Mount Holyoke and have really liked it, but was unsure of what direction I wanted to go in. You know, I knew I didn't want to do kind of like strict health sciences research, you know, anything like that. I also didn't take like any science classes at Mount Holyoke. I took neuroscience. I took intro to neuroscience and that was it.
That's scary.
Yeah, it was scary. My grade was scary. No, it was okay. But, you know, I knew that I like, it's kind of like chipping away at like a big marble to like get to whatever's underneath. It's like, you can kind of like chip away at your interest until you figure out what you really want. And so for me, occupational therapy is a way to really get grounded in the kind of care that I believe in, but also the kind of research that I'm interested in as well. So like there's an ability to do clinical work, but also to come back to research later. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, like in terms of how it relates to queerness, like I think that bodily communication, which is like so much of occupational therapy, is to me like a big part of how I figured out my own queerness and how I think of my queerness in relation to other people. So it to me, it's like, oh, obviously, it's like the gayest thing ever, duh. But like,
right. Yeah, totally.
Do you feel like queerness fits into yes. midwifery for you?
So I did a doula training 2 weekends ago. Mm-hmm. And on the third, so it was a 3-day training. And on the third day of the training, we actually did a lot of role playing and like touching each other and practicing, you know, applying pressure in different positions and, you know, got the hang for a lot of the tactics that are useful for doulas to use with birthing people. And something that the instructor said at the beginning is she was like, you know, she was talking just about like the bond that she's developed with a lot of the people that she was their doula. And she was talking about intimacy and vulnerability, which obviously I was like, fuck yeah. And she was talking about...
I love the
about...
juxtaposition of you going, fuck yeah, intimacy, fuck yeah.
Right, as everyone, there's like incense burning. But she was talking about how one of the things that is often a good position, a comfortable position to alleviate some of the discomfort of labor pains is having the person who's pregnant, it's basically slow dancing. So they have their arms wrapped around the neck of somebody
wow.
and they're arching their back a little bit. So they're mm-hmm. kind of pressing their belly almost to the person and the other person has their hands on that birthing person's lower back. Mm-hmm. So she was describing being in that position mm-hmm. with a birthing woman. And she was saying how, like, she had this this was one of her first births. And she had this moment of realizing, like, oh, my God, this is such a sensual and intimate experience. I'm holding this woman. We're both sweating. We're crying. She's moaning. Like, you're so close to one another. There's so much heat exchange between two people. And it's such a, like, such a non-sexual, like, physical, sensual experience with another human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's gay.
Yeah. That's the best part about being queer is that, like, all of the rules of, like, not being supposed to, like, behave certain ways with your friends. Like, no, it's between relationships. Like, we get to set the rules. Like, that's the best part about being queer is that, like, you can make out with your friends if that's what you guys want
to
do.
Well, it starts rocks. To, like, rewrite the ways that you think about relationships, I think, for me. Like, queerness to me is allows for a kind of breathability in all your relationships because there's, like, this idea of pretense is kind of shatters because it has to. I think it's really interesting. I think, actually, so as part of the workshop, we had to do an exercise where we wrote about our ideal birth experience. Like, what are the parameters of our personal, like, where do we want it? Who do we want there? What do we need? Exactly, you know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine from nursing school actually came to the doula training with me, who listens to the podcast, so hey. and when we were doing the exercise, she said that it was important to her to not have men as part of her birth experience. And I was like, I hadn't even thought of that, but I don't want men either. Like, and I really was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, for me, I think part of it is being a queer woman and that kind of thing. To me, like, I'm a cis woman. Mm-hmm. I feel very aligned with femininity and with womanhood and, and, you know, the idea of a birth that's centered around that feminine energy is really important for me, for my personal experience. But a lot of the workshops was about how to incorporate the partner, how to make the, how to not replace the partner, but teach the partner how to provide things for the birthing person. And it was cool because we talked about things kind of without gender, because anybody could be a birthing person. Anybody could be their partner in their birth, whether or not they're their partner in life and romantic involvement.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting too when you're, you know, you're talking about imagining yourself as the patient and the provider and, like, kind of talking about the duality of working in healthcare, which I think is particularly complex for queer people. And it, so there's a really, really cool book that I love and I'm currently loaning out to a friend, and she took some photos of it because I wanted to read parts of it tonight.
So generous.
It's very nice. But so the book is called The Remedy, Queer and Trans Voices on Health and Healthcare. It's curated by Zena Sharman and it is so good. I highly recommend it. It is providers and patients and people of lots of different identities and at different intersections talking about healthcare and what it means to them.
Is it essays?
It's, yeah, short essays, poems, like short submissions. Very, very good. But there's one in particular, which is about, is this by a genderqueer therapist who talks about working with trans and gender nonconforming communities and writing letters to get, like, gender affirming healthcare. So, like, to get hormones, to get, like, or whatever else, like, a person is desiring in terms of, like, having their healthcare affirm their gender. Like, this therapist is like, I'm going to do this for you, but it's complicated. So I want to read you the part of how it's complicated. Yeah. So this excerpt is from Confessions of a Gender Specialist by Sand Chang. I continually question my own motives and rationalizations. I've told myself that it is a reality that there are gates and someone has to be there to open them. But why not work to destroy these gates? Am I no different from the people who acted as gatekeepers in early gender clinics? As health professionals, many of them thought they were doing good. I may not be scrutinizing people for a convincing gender story, as in, I couldn't care less what kind of childhood toys a person played with, but I'm still evaluating the capacity to provide informed consent. Is this a way of disguising the gates, or am I just making them invisible? So, and then a little bit later, San says, There's also the issue of what I'm calling dual otherness, being both the gatekeeper and part of the community. How this plays out in my life and work is that among other gatekeepers, like doctors, surgeons, and therapists, I'm not always taken seriously because I'm perceived as having in-group bias or advocating too hard for affirming care. And with clients and sometimes other members of trans and gender nonconforming communities, I may be viewed as the enemy. Other trans and gender nonconforming folks don't always see me as similar to them, either because my genderqueer identity or expression doesn't qualify me for real trans or gender nonconforming status, whatever that means, because I have class and education privilege that affords me a position of power, because my versions of masculinity and femininity fuck with the very white and medicalized ideals and narratives that these concepts are based on, and because I will never know what it's like to be in their shoes. That's fair. My privilege in this dynamic is undeniable. I'm suspicious of my own narcissistic need to be seen as good in these contexts.
Wow.
So that was a doozy of an excerpt. It was pretty long, I know.
It was beautiful.
But what I love so much about it is that it's talking about, like, the power imbalance is always going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about birth or thinking about anything that we're going into, like, we've been patients before.
Right.
And it's so different to be, like, how do you navigate the idea of gatekeeping and, you know.
Totally.
Yeah. I don't know.
Something that's interesting to me in regards to, like, power dynamics between patients and providers, mm-hmm. As I pursue nursing, is the concept of outing yourself to patients. Mm-hmm. And I have been thinking about this nonstop for maybe 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about it all the time. A lot of queer people have not been to the doctor in a very, very long time. People die.
Yeah.
Because of how traumatizing healthcare can be.
Right.
They also die because of healthcare, right. Sometimes, you know?
Right.
But anyways, the reason I bring that up is because I think that the first queer person that I knew was my pediatrician. Mm. And when I told her I thought I was gay when I was 12, she told me, like, oh yeah, well, I'm gay and I'm married. Like, I have a wife and I have 2 kids. And, like, I was just like, what the fuck? Like, you know, and she said it in a way that was dismissive. And that being dismissive was the best thing she could have done. Like, mm-hmm. You know, in some moments that would have felt like shit, but it mm-hmm. actually was like, oh yeah, this is just normal. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, how long do you spend with your doctor at a pediatrician appointment? 15 minutes, maybe, at the most. So, like, for her to be like, oh, please, like,
yeah,
it's okay. You're fine. You shouldn't even waste your time being upset about that because, like, you got it. You're going to mm-hmm. be fine. And I didn't even know that she was, mm-hmm. like, queer before that. And it really, like, just, I felt so safe going to her from then on. And mm-hmm. I went to her until I was 22. Mm-hmm. And they finally kicked me out of the pediatricians. But I was so, like, her outing herself to me really changed the dynamic of our relationship.
Right.
It changed how I felt about it. Because they also did my, they were pediatric and adolescent care. So they did my pap smears. They did my cervical mm-hmm. exam. Like, they did all my, like, gynecological care as well. Mm-hmm. And so...
And this doctor, this pediatrician did
the exams. Yeah. Yeah. And I, like, talked to her about losing my virginity, talked to her about sexual experiences, talked to her about, you know, like, STD testing. And mm-hmm. and I always just felt so safe. I felt like I could ask her anything. And I found it really empowering to know, like, oh, my doctor's queer.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. She was amazing.
That's so wonderful, too, that you got gynecological care from her. I think that's, you know, my girlfriend and I were joking about this recently that... Like, where is the stand-up comedy about, like, queer women going to the gynecologist? I'm sure it's out there. And actually, if you know of some, send it our way, because yes. I'm trying to find some. And I'm not trying to, like, say that any cool lesbian comedian out there has to be doing it. But, like, you know, it is, like, I feel like when we talk about it, when I talk to, like, other queer women about going to the gynecologist, everybody has, like, a really strong and visceral reaction to it. And I think a lot of people who go to gynecologists do in general, mm-hmm. but like, it is truly a vault that I just want to rip open so badly because I have not gotten a pap smear in probably like 3 years because I just don't, you know, and I live in Boston and I know a shit ton of queer women and all of them have a recommendation on which gynecologist to go to. And mm-hmm. I could probably just do it and it would probably be fine. But like, the idea makes me want to, like, put nails underneath my fingers.
Yeah.
Like, underneath my fingernails, like, in that little spot.
Well.
Oh, my God.
Well, also, so I should have said this earlier, but part of the reason that I decided to pursue nurse midwifery, specifically, is because
I want to be able to provide people pelvic care. I'm going to use the word pelvic rather than gynecological or reproductive. Right. Because I want to be a provider for queer people and to, like, help rewrite those traumatic experiences and help people feel safe. And even if it's begrudgingly, at least have people feel comfortable enough to be like, okay, well, I have to get my teeth cleaned. Right. To treat it that way. To be like, okay, no one likes this, but at least I can feel comfortable and not triggered and horrified getting it done. Although research is showing that cervical exams and pap smears are often done more than they're actually required, that it's really not necessary to do them as frequently as
How I've justified not having a gynecologist in the city I live in. I'm like, yeah, but like science says they don't need it.
Yeah. But no, I've actually been really lucky, and I think part of it was first having that pediatrician, because they also use plastic speculums, which is not great for planet Earth.
But like, hello. But it's
so much better. Yeah.
It's just, I think it's so, you know, you said like going to the dentist, and like, for me, like I think about, I never think about being gay more than when I'm going to the fucking doctor, and it doesn't matter what doctor it is, but like, I feel so queer at the doctor and like just so strange, like every time. And like the dentist and the eye doctor and like everybody, and I think about like my plans to go into occupational therapy, and as like much as like I want queerness to like, it's part of who I am, it's going to be part of what my practice is, like I know that to be true about myself, there's also part of me which like sheepishly is kind of like, I don't have to, like it's not like I don't have to think about it the same way, you know, like I can't imagine going into OBGYN or any kind of like pelvic care. I can't imagine, like there's so much of like of what is traditionally seen as like women's health that I feel like I'm like, that's like a whole nother world away. You know what I mean? Even though occupational therapy can be messy and full of bodies and like complicated, and but there's something about like, it does feel like a vault, you know, it feels like something I don't really want to open. Like
something about gynecology that I think is interesting. So there's a blog called The Feminist Midwife. I think I may have mentioned her previously. She's a midwife, and something that she does that's really cool on her blog is she does these scripts. So it'll literally be a script of like, these are the ways to ask these kinds of questions in a way that is gender affirming or is like makes people feel safe if they're survivors or whatever. And she'll do things like, she'll talk about like announcing you're going to touch someone and asking if that's okay before you do. You know, a lot of times you go to a pelvic exam and they like touch you and start doing stuff before they even talk to you. And she has like code systems where like she'll begin a pelvic exam and then someone has like, there's certain codes. Like if you say red, I'm going to stop and I'm going to stop, like pull out all the tools and stop immediately. If you say yellow, I'm going to proceed with caution, but I know that like you're getting uncomfortable. If you say green, everything's good. Like things like that. And I think something that is really important for me to want, that I want to implement and that I wish more care providers did, is asking people the language they want to use for their anatomy, which is really not that hard. But people have different words they want to use. Some words are triggering, some words are gross to people. You know, like people have preferences, and it's such a simple thing, but it really can establish trust between you and your patient. And, you know, there is a privilege. I have this education. I'm getting paid to do this. You're paying to come and get this service. I, like, you know, I can identify certain things about your body that you cannot identify about your own body. But that doesn't mean you should feel authority. You know, like there can be power, but there doesn't necessarily have to be authority. You know, like I want to ask you, how can I make this experience comfortable for you? What language do you want me to use? Because it's patient-centered, it's not provider-centered. You know, like this may be an experience that you are reluctantly doing. How can I make it quick and dirty, over and done with as fast as possible, if that's what you need? You know?
And I think, did you read in the, I think it was in the Boston Globe, an article that came out about it was about LGBT health disparity. And it was particularly about that, like, they did a survey of doctors nationwide and found that like the majority of them don't ask about, but So the study was framed as they don't ask about sexual orientation or gender identity. And I feel like what you're talking about like, what words do you like to use to describe yourself is the opposite. So like you have a provider who's saying like, we are going to work with this like material and this like your body, like this material place that we're in and like your, like where you are in your headspace. And like, how are we going to talk about it that makes it the most comfortable mm-hmm. as opposed to being like, you know, when I read that article in the Boston Globe about asking for sexuality, I'm like, that doesn't tell you anything. Like right. if like having a doctor remember to say like, oh, do you identify as gay? What does right. that do? Right. Like, like you don't really learn anything from it. Like there are so many experiences that are like very particular. And like one of the things that I learned like this last fall is that there are very few studies done on chest binding mm-hmm. and like the health effects of chest binding and like what just like knowledge about it at all. And I realized like, I know that like, I like, this is just my one experience, but like, I don't bind my chest when I go to the doctor. Mm-hmm. Like I bind a lot of other times, but like, I just like, don't, I just avoid the whole thing.
But even if you are binding and you go to the doctor and you're sitting in a Johnny, mm-hmm. probably not wearing a binder because you know, they're probably going to listen to your lungs and mm-hmm. you know, and how many of them are going to look at your pile of clothes and be like, oh, so you're binding. Most straight cis doctors are not going to know mm-hmm. to, and they're not going to ask.
Well, and so actually on an episode of Take My Wife with Cameron and Rhea for season 2, Brittany Nichols is in it and has like a really cool cameo role, where she is binding and goes to the doctor and the doctor's like, it's just like a regular checkup or something. So the doctor goes in to like listen to her breath, but like doesn't ask her to like remove any of her clothes. And is like, What is this? Like, what the hell is this? You know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, yes, like it was so cool to see that represented right. because it is like, I look at that and I'm like, yeah. That is exactly where my brain plays out when I'm like, mm-hmm. I'll just wear a sports bra. Mm-hmm. I'll just like feel like shit and like wear a sports bra and that'll be mm-hmm. fine. Like it's so, you know, it's, there's so much to do with experience that is not in labels. Like, I feel like mm-hmm. it's just too easy to slap like LGBTQ. Like there's so much variety in what right. people need.
And also like people are not necessarily, I mean, thinking about people's queer experiences at Mount Holyoke, mm-hmm. even like how many people do you know who didn't and probably don't still identify as queer or bisexual or gay or anything who were having sex with women mm-hmm. or, you know what I mean? Or right, like non-binary exactly. people or, you know, DFAB people or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. like people are also not out.
Like every fucking time I go to the doctor and like, and it's like a good experience. Like I'll go to Fenway Health, which is like a queer focused space or like other things like that. And I'm like, okay, like I made it through another doctor's appointment. And I feel okay. Like, I'm feeling also like incredibly fucking grateful that like I have health insurance and like mm-hmm. I didn't have to pay like a ridiculous amount of money out of pocket. And like I was able to like take 30 minutes out of work to like go do this mm-hmm. tacked onto my lunch break and like didn't have to worry about losing my job. Like totally. There's so much like there's so much privilege in that. And then if I think about the fact that like I'm still like I feel like I'm like touch and go on every doctor's appointment, like the idea of health disparity is like mm-hmm. it's so much bigger than just yeah. like any one thing. Like,
oh, that's something that we kind of talked about at the doula training. We like joked about how like everyone needs a doula for every appointment ever mm-hmm. because there's someone advocating for you and just offering to, you know, to keep like restating for you. I mean, how many times have I been like, oh, when I go to the doctor, not even about queer stuff, but been like, oh, I've been having this pain in my hip, I'm gonna bring this up. And then when I get there, they're like, do you have any questions? I'm like, no. Nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Nothing. I'm great. And it feels kind of like there's this obligation to be a good patient.
Right.
People always want to be a good patient. They don't want to bother you. I mean, that's a huge problem. And I'm sure that you've talked about this in research at work is like in geriatric populations of elderly people, mm-hmm. Lowballing their pain because they don't want to be an inconvenience.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think that like that happens across age ranges too. Like people want to be good patients. They want to be efficient and they want to get out of your way and they don't want too much intervention and everything like that. But so, you know, that often means that things that you were like, oh, when I go, I'm going to say this, I'm going to talk about this and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, this is the most often translated into problems with reaching out about mental health stuff. Mm-hmm. And like a doula in a birth scenario is like, well, when we talked about your birth plan, you mentioned like not wanting this, or you mentioned that this was really important to you. Like, is that still the case for you? And being that person to kind of bridge the gap between the patient and the doctor, like to kind of disturb that power imbalance and be like, okay, yeah, but like, remember here, like it's the patient who's like the important person here.
Right.
So we like joked about like, oh yeah, people going to get like EKGs should like have doulas with them and everything. Being like, okay, yeah, but like he really said he didn't want this. So like, can you just like not do that?
Right. It's so true though. And I think, you know, we don't even need more studies, but they've done more studies that show that like women don't have their pain respected at all. And like to levels we like didn't once know. And like particularly women of color and Black women in particular, like people just don't take pain very seriously.
Yeah.
Depending on who's talking about it. But I think, so in terms of what you're talking about, like sometimes I will gaslight myself. Like when I tore my ACL, I waited a full week and, you know, I talked to my parents about it. I was laying on the couch. I had crutches. I was just waiting. I was like, I probably just sprained it or something. And my parents were like, yeah. Like they're 3,000 miles away. They're like, yeah, you probably sprained it. Like, I don't really know. They don't know. They didn't see it. Right. And I'm like, it's the size of a fucking, like, orange. It's ginormous. Like, you know, and so, like, I'll do it to myself. I'll be like, you know what? I'm being dramatic. I don't want to be that person who goes into the doctor and they go, you just sprained it. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I don't want to overreact. But at the same time, I had a psychiatrist last year where I was like, I don't want to take this medicine. Like, I know what the side effects are and I don't want it. And she was like, well, okay, but like, why don't you just try it with like a low dose? And I was like, no, like, I don't want to take this medicine. Like, I don't want to have gastrointestinal problems for the next like 6 months. Like, no, thank you. Right. You know, like, I don't want to have like itchy skin forever. Like, no. And like, they've said like, well, you know, sorry, like, you know, this is the regular line of treatment, or like, this is what we know is the right thing to do. And it's like, okay, but this isn't me gaslighting myself. Like, when you do finally work up the courage to ask for what you need and then you get shot down for it, that fucking sucks too.
Right.
And it just reinforces it. It's enough
to make you not do it the next time.
Exactly.
Totally. So there's a group, and I know that it's in Boston. I don't know if it's based out of Boston or not, and I will try and find it. And if I do, I will post about it just on our Instagram and Twitter. But they are like volunteer advocates for LGBTQ IA plus patients. And you can, there's like an advocate for anybody who needs one, but a lot of people don't know that the resource exists. And so they will like have just for like doctor's appointments for like basically any thing like that. Yeah. And they're free.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I think it's through like a law center or something, but I will try and find out more about that to share with people who listen.
That's a great resource. I mean, that's something that Nancy and I have talked about before. Like, you know, we'll often be like, oh, you don't have to come to my doctor's appointment. Like, you don't, like, I don't want you to have to take the time off work. And, oh, like, you know, it's such a pain in the ass. Like, I could just be an adult and deal with it. But there are times when, like, having anyone else in the room for any person, regardless of all of these identities, like, we know that they get better care. Like, people get better care when there's someone there with them, almost always. But, like, in particular, if you're trying to explain things that people don't know anything about, or even, like, you know, they don't even think to ask you, you know? Like, there's so many things that, like, that people just, like, don't, that providers don't even realize is going to be in front of your face all the time, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think that it's actually been really interesting, the, like, being in nursing school. Well, first of all, I have a lot more of my parents calling me and asking me medical questions. Like, my mom asking me, like, oh, like, you know, will you look at this? You think it's a spider bite? And shit like that. I'm like, I don't know. Like,
okay, what? In all fairness, I did ask you last night if it was a problem that it was taking me a really long time to pee. So, cool.
True. I mean, some things I'm like, okay, I can tell you. You know, like, oh, this drug, like, yeah, it does this thing and there's this side effect, or like things like that. But it's interesting, and it feels kind of good to know that as my parents get older and eventually experience health complications, that I'll be able to be a support for them, that I can kind of go into the room with them and be like, okay, but like, no bullshit, what's the deal? And already, you know, like when I've gone to the fucking wellness clinic at CVS and been like, so like, these are my symptoms, this is how long it's been happening, and I'm using like jargon. I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, so I'm not coughing up any sputum. It's blah, 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 blah. I'm not doing this. And when I can, like, when they say like, oh, like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I'm in nursing school. There's immediately a shift.
Right.
There's a shift in the power dynamic. We're more equal. And they speak to me like I'm a person.
Yeah.
Instead of like I'm a docile patient. And I wonder how your experience with this will be as you begin to work in healthcare as well.
So working, like, I do, I got to learn a lot of jargon, as you're saying, in doing research. And obviously, like, it's not like, you know, I'm never wearing scrubs. It's like not, like, you know, there's never that level of it. But, like, I think there is a certain amount of, like, educational privilege and gatekeeping that happens in mm-hmm. terms of, like, as if, like, you don't know your own body if right. you didn't study organic chemistry.
That information is often more valuable.
Right.
Because you know your baseline.
But so there's that part of it. And I do also think there's something to be said about choosing the profession, that like there is a privilege to like working specifically in healthcare or like mm-hmm. knowing healthcare in particular. I would say particularly in a city like Boston, where that's so much of what the city does right. is healthcare. But yeah, I'm really curious how it's going to go. And I think because like I know that it's a privilege and I'm very aware of the privilege of being able to interact with that world and like being able to say like, no, okay, like I'm going to utilize this to work out for me. Like mm-hmm. I'm going to go into this doctor's appointment and try to get what I need out of it and mm-hmm. not be worked around.
Mm-hmm.
Like when that does happen to me, like when I do have, you know, a couple psychiatrists in a row who like totally fuck me over, or, you know, I don't get care that I was expecting, or I get like, you know, a doctor says something kind of fucked up to me, that makes me feel like there's like nothing in the world that makes me feel more small than that, or mm-hmm. like more just like completely like shit on, because it's like I've become aware of like how much I have lost the privilege of like we're on the same, like yeah. you know, they see me as any kind of like part of that world.
Totally.
It's so, I mean, it's like unbelievable. I don't know if there's any other profession that is like healthcare in that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe there is, I don't know.
Yeah, and I definitely think that things are changing. I mean, my doula training, there were so many, so it was at Harvard. And there were so many Harvard undergrad pre-med kids there. There was, like, people who were in med school currently. There mm-hmm. were people who were, like, totally going with the medical model of healthcare, who were still interested in kind of broadening their understanding of the midwifery model, mm-hmm. which is, like, so patient-centered rather than provider-centered. And so that's a little bit heartening to see,
yeah.
you know, to see, like, okay, well, there are people, you know, and I think that feminist healthcare is becoming much more common. I mean, it's like a shift that is happening, which mm-hmm. is nice, but doesn't solve.
No. I don't want to be cynical, but there's also one of the things that I find to be very disheartening is hearing people who are like, you know, aspiring med students say things like, oh yeah, like I'm totally interested in like a midwifery model, but like you have to have an OB on call because like,
right.
you know, births can be really dangerous. And right. it's like, even that, just that, like, yes, bad things can happen, but even that phrasing, like, you're still thinking of it as, like, a diagnosis, mm-hmm. as, like, something
right.
to...
Right, you're pathologizing.
Exactly.
It. Yeah.
And, like, that is, like, you know, I think that there's still, like, watching people teach themselves that they're so sure of fact. Like, there's so much fucking guessing that goes into healthcare, of, like, guessing of, like, what to do and what medicines to try and how things are gonna work. And, like, I don't know when providers, like, start convincing themselves deep down that what they're doing is like true fact that could never be wrong, mm-hmm. like objective fact. Mm-hmm. I hope I never get there.
Yeah.
Like, I really hope not.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, I think that for a lot of people in a lot of professions, which is why it was really important to me that the program that I go into was an accelerated bachelor's, because in these kinds of programs, they start you off in a clinical setting mm-hmm. right away. My first semester, I had clinical. And now, you know, this past semester, I had 3 days of being in two different hospitals. And you can read about stuff as much as you want, but context is so important. I'm never going to forget what spironolactone does mm-hmm. because I gave it to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that was like, they needed it. And I watched, so it's a diuretic. I watched their weight change as they peed and got rid of excess fluid and their lungs sounded clearer. And so wow. there is something important about evidence-based practice.
And, oh, yeah.
And there is, like, something that, like, is like, okay, wow, like, you know, I like, see that this thing really did this thing that I've read that it does in textbooks.
Yeah, better living through chemistry is what my mom says. Yeah.
But I think that without that clinical experience, I may have read that in a textbook, and it's such a different thing.
Right.
You know, even though in this case it did align with what I had read about it and, you know, whatever, I think that a lot of times I'll meet it's their first time being residents. They just graduated med school. And I'm like, wow, you don't know fucking anything. But they have so much faith in what they've been taught. Mm-hmm. And so much of med school is teaching people that their patients are not people, they're patients.
Right.
So, like, it takes, you know, and it's like, you gotta fucking talk to people, and people know themselves. And there's so much value in working with people and being on the ground with them. So I think that's really important to me. And I think that is a way that I kind of navigate reconciling all of the distaste I have for the medical industrial complex with pursuing a job in that. I think that for me, part of my activism and part of my approach to kind of combating these horrible systems is to, like, actually physically do the shit, you know, to, like, talk to patients about real shit, to ask them about their bodies, their experiences, how they're feeling. And I think that doing the doula training was really cool too, because it provided me with even more language to ask those kinds of questions, particularly about birthing people, but in ways that I can apply to so many other fields.
I think it's so that there's a certain, like, when the rubber meets the road to healthcare that I think is really cool. Like, totally. It has a lot of potential, you know?
Yeah. And it also is like, you know, there's something really special and moving about meeting people, you know? And I think that, of course, when I was interested in abortion care and access, and then interested in birth, and I wrote a lot of poems about birth and lactation my senior year of Mount Holyoke, as a means of, like, kind of working through a lot of this stuff and reading a lot of, like, gender theory and queer theory and talking about bodies. And I was using a lot of theory and philosophical language to talk about real tangible bodies. And I thought a little bit about public health, but it was really important to me to actually physically be doing things with people. And it's not true for everyone. Like, some people are going to be so much better suited for other things. Some people say, like, oh, you've, like, wiped people's butts. I could never do that. Which to me, it's like, okay, but you have a butt. Like, just really, chill. Really. Oh, and it's like the grossest shit in nursing is, like, it's just stuff. Like, you're going to be fine. Like, yeah. It's really like bodies are not that gross.
Yeah.
You're just socialized to think that they are when they're not operating in an abled way.
Right. And, like, with really fucked up ideas of, like, sterileness and all of the other things that go with it.
Wrong. Don't ever touch a curtain at a hospital. They never clean those.
Ew.
Don't, like, the curtains between people's beds? Yuck.
So we are going to play another round of If I Was Your Boyfriend, a la Jay Biebs. For those of you who were not around for the first time, we basically are just going to list people and talk about what we would do if we dated them. Mia, are you ready?
I'm not ready for the first one.
Well, too bad. Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, man. I don't even know. Nancy Pelosi. If I was your boyfriend,
I would have stopped you from going on Drag Race. What was that? Come on.
Come on. Yeah.
That's it, really.
I honestly have nothing to say about Nancy Pelosi.
Okay. That's fair. She probably has nothing to say about you.
No, she would have a lot to say. We're exes. She's my ex. Maggie.
Yeah.
Michelle Visage. Michelle Visage.
Michelle Visage, if I was your boyfriend, I would say that to you anytime you walked into a room. Michelle Visage is here.
Michelle Visage, if I was your boyfriend, I promise I would never confuse you at a Drag Race reunion with Ben De La Creme.
Oh my god. Michelle Visage. I would politely recommend that you stop being so aggressively annoying about calling yourself an LGBTQ plus ally. But thank you for your service to Drag Race. Okay, Mia. Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart, if I was your boyfriend, I would... You know, I would be able to look past Twilight.
Look past Twilight?
Her acting in Twilight is sincerely divine. Wretched.
Fabulous. Inspired.
I would be okay with you biting your lip.
Oh, yeah, me too. I'd be okay with you biting my lip.
Anyways. Alex Trebek.
Oh, if I was your boyfriend, we would just break up because you're a Republican shithead. Did you know that? He's very conservative.
I did not. He's the host of Jeopardy, right?
Yeah, he's the host of Jeopardy.
Alex Trebek, if I was your boyfriend, it'd be like double Jeopardy all the time. I don't know. I love Jeopardy.
I also love Jeopardy. If I was your boyfriend, the couple, Timothée Chalamet and Armand Hammer.
If I was y'all's boyfriend, I would never bring home peaches. Peach-free household.
Peach-free. We're all none allergic. Of that.
Just gross.
So I eat oranges every day at lunch because it's a great way to make your breath smell good after lunch, kind of close it out. So I eat navel oranges. And navel oranges, you kind of have to like dig your thumb in to like pull it out, like the little navel part. And I cannot stop fucking thinking about him pitting that peach. Yes. And every time I do it at work, I'm like, does it look like I'm sticking my thumb in a butthole right now?
You like, look like that Instagram. You know that Instagram where that girl just fingers fruit?
Yeah.
With like honey and cream all over it. That's what you're up to.
You're not wrong. Okay, one more. Mia.
Yes.
If I was your boyfriend, Christina Yang.
I was hoping you would do her. Oh, Christina Yang. If I was your boyfriend, I would never let you go. I would take you places that you've never been before. Christina Yang, if I was your boyfriend, I would totally put up with you being an absolute workaholic and really probably not wanting me around at all. I would love you till the day I died.
Christina Yang, I also don't want kids, so I feel like we're more compatible than you were with any of your men's on the show. Mm-hmm. And I don't like blood that much, so you could have all of my OR time. You don't have to fight me for it.
Oh, I would be your scrub. Like, scrub nurse.
Like, oh, like scalpel.
Yes. But also, I'd be her scrub in scrubs. I would do anything for Sandra. All right, guys, so that's our episode. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts and opinions, want to call us out, want to call us in, want to call us by your name. Yeah, you like that?
I love that.
So feel free to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on iTunes. Send us a message or an email, DM us, message us on Twitter, etc. We'll be continuing the conversation over on Twitter. And we'll be posting about our bitch crafts on Instagram as well. Next week, we're going to be talking about gay books, so be sure to send us your recommendations. We will put out a blast for that as well. And stay tuned for that.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.